Although it has instantaneous 24/7 trading, think of it like a venture investment. Figure out how much money you're willing to lose, just put that amount in, and then, you know, hold it.
So we're rocking and rolling. And so joining us now on Speak Up, this is a huge get for me because he is an OG in the crypto space. It's Dan Moorhead from Pantera Capital. And Dan, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about the history of the firm. But what I love about this firm is you got into crypto before any of us even knew what crypto is, or at least I didn't know what crypto was. I think you were there in 13 ahead of the Winklevoss brothers. But, you know, you're a TradeFi guy, Mr. Moorhead. So what happened? Tell us a little bit about the beginning of the firm and tell us about the apple that hit you on the head to move you a decade ahead of the rest of us into crypto. And thanks for joining the show.
Oh, Anthony, thanks for having me on. No, it's fun. The background is I've been a global macro trader my whole career, and I was previously at Tiger Management, you know, looking around the world to find things where the reward was very asymmetric, you know, a lot of upside, but yeah, you know, ways you could lose money. And so every 3 or 4 years, something cool would come along, you know, Russian privatization or Middle East equities or the Brazilian real or whatever, you know. And so, you know, those were good trades. They were worth doing. But in 2011, my brother introduced me to Bitcoin. And at the time, they were literally giving them away for free. Gavin Andreessen, the chief scientist of Bitcoin, had this thing called Bitcoin Faucet. And if you signed up, you would get free Bitcoins from them because it was such a young project. And I have a bit of a libertarian streak in me. And I was like, hey, that sounds great. I hope this Bitcoin thing works. But it didn't actually do anything for like a year. And then a couple of friends of mine wanted me to really help them think through Bitcoin. And as I read about it, it took a while to get my head around it. But it really, the light bulb moment, like you said, was just realizing this is the kind of the biggest advancement in finance in 500 years, right? Like double entry bookkeeping was great. And so banks have made a lot of money over the last five centuries, keeping everyone's ledgers for them. But that trust has been really expensive, right? Banks keep blowing up, taxpayers bail them out. They charge a lot of fees. Credit card companies still charge 300 basis points to an electronic transaction in 2024. That's obviously anti-competitive pricing. Migrants still pay a month's wages to send their remittance back home. So all of these, quote, trust systems from the legacy finance world are super expensive and frankly slow, and they get hacked, and there's lots of other disadvantages. And that's what Bitcoin is. And that was a light bulb moment, is that anyone on earth with a smartphone can send money or even other kinds of digital property to each other, basically instantaneously and basically free. And so it's going to disrupt, you know, the world, right?
All right. Well, we're both old enough, though, to know that there wasn't e-cash in the 90s. We're both old enough to know that there were attempts for digital payment systems, and all of those failed. But there was something very unique about Bitcoin, the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper, that allowed it to grow and start to exponentially proliferate. What was that, Dan? And I can see, I think it looks like some of that's behind you. What is that? Is that the white paper behind you?
Yeah, Anthony, the wild thing is the entire white paper fits on one small wall. Like, that's what's so wild about the genius of Satoshi, is the entire Bitcoin project's 3,000 words. And you know, fits on, you know, a few pieces of paper. So there were some very good projects before that. Nick Szabo did a project that was fantastic. Adam Back did Hashcash. And there were a couple of projects that were very close, but each one was kind of missing that one critical element. And Satoshi's the first person to put them all together so that essentially trust is provided by free cryptography rather than these expensive, you know, legacy finance systems. And that's why it's taken off so, you know, so well. There's, you know, probably 400 million people now using it. It's really grown.
So I'm gonna fully embarrass myself on my own show. I have a tweet from 2012. I don't understand Bitcoin. It sounds like nonsense. Caveat emptor. Don't we have a tweet for everything just to fully embarrass ourselves. So I totally missed it. I didn't see it. I said to myself, okay, this is a cryptographic code. I'll quote some TradeFi people that call it financial blather or mathematical blather. But so I didn't see it. I didn't really understand it. I got to the White House. And of course, I had a short stay in the White House. This happened on a Wednesday, Dan, because I was only there for one Wednesday. So I remember it was a Wednesday. The Fed came in to talk about digitizing the dollar. I was like, what the hell are they talking about? They go, no, we want to do this over the blockchain. You're already 4 or 5 years into it. I'm not anywhere near it. And it became clear to me that we're going in this direction. But what do you say to our TradeFi friends that haven't looked at it, don't understand it? What do you say to viewers and listeners who frankly don't have the Satoshi white paper on their wall, haven't spent as much time in finance as you or me? How do you get them comfortable with all this? Because there's been some frightening volatility. There's been a lot of naysayers. There's been the SEC beating a drum against it. How do you get people comfortable that this is going to be a big part of their future?
Yeah, so, you know, we start out talking about a bunch of the reasons why it could be really valuable, because it's replacing credit card companies, banks, remittance companies, all these super expensive businesses out there. But even if someone doesn't really want to buy that, the simplest argument I make to investors is best way to build a portfolio is to buy a bunch of diverse things. And you don't have to be right on every single one of them, right? You don't have to have 100% certainty that Bitcoin's going to be the thing. If you have a portfolio with a bunch of things in there, as long as they have good expected return and they're not very correlated, you're going to do well. Bitcoin is the dream asset. It has a 11-year compound annual growth rate of almost 100%. So it almost doubles every year. And it does that with almost no correlation to the S&P 500. It's 0.1. So if you could ever find an asset that has expects to double every year and have no correlation to anything else you own, that is a dream asset. It also has a really cool feature. Bitcoin has a four-year kind of periodicity because they cut the supply every 4 years. Anyone that's ever held Bitcoin for 4 years has more than doubled their money. And you and I know, we've traded a lot of things over the last 35 years. There's no other asset class like that, that if you've held it for 4 years, you're guaranteed, well, in the past, you've always made money. And so that is normally enough to get people to budge. And when people ask how much they should have in their portfolio, I just say the only wrong answer is zero. Like, depends on your circumstances, how old you are, like where you are in the risk spectrum, all that stuff. But that's really what people need to do, is get off zero and put a percent or two of their either personal net worth or their professional portfolio in. And what I've found over 11 years of talking to people about this, within a couple of months, they're already buying more and they're learning about it. And kind of those initial knee-jerk skepticisms have all gone away.
Okay, so let me push a little, okay? And I'm going to switch topics on you, but let me push a little. Jamie Dimon says it's a pet rock. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's decentralized nonsense. You've got places like Vanguard, one of the largest ETF providers in the world, said, you know what? Bitcoin ETF, not for me. You have journalists. I go on these shows. One woman said to me, well, obviously, you're just buying this because its number go up. And there's crowd psychology here. And the minute the crowd loses confidence in this, they're going to flood out of it. And so there's no intrinsic value to it. Help me. Help me. I got to steal ideas from you, Moorhead. Help me go on television and combat these people. Go ahead. What do you say?
Yeah. So, I mean, I love that argument. I've been hearing it for so long, too. The intrinsic value of a Jackson Pollock is $40. It's some canvas and some house paint. But there's a 70-year track record of Jackson Pollocks being a very good place to store your wealth. There's a limited supply of them, provable authenticity, all that. It's the same with Bitcoin, or I would even say, if you want to go all the way out there, gold, right? Why'd they pick number 79 in the periodic table? There's no special reason gold is what people have used for money for 5,000 years, but it has a 5,000-year track record of doing that. So Bitcoin's only 15 years old. So it needs to keep growing, keep evolving. But that is the way to think about it, is anything can be money. Anything can be value, gold, Jackson Pollock, seashells, whatever. And Bitcoin does it very well because it does it very cheaply. It's never failed. It's been 24/7 uptime for 15 years. So when people do, you know, use that kind of knee jerk argument, there's no intrinsic value, you can easily deal with that. And then, you know, I would imagine some of the people who have been super negative about crypto are really thinking from their own competitive standpoint, that if you're a bank and you issue a lot of credit cards, you probably don't want your customers being able to do all that by themselves on their own smartphone. They don't want to, you know, route around the bank. So banks are certainly threatened by Bitcoin.
Where do you think things are going?
Yeah, so it is a parlor game to make the most outlandish prediction out there, and people want to, you know, put a million or whatever. I've been saying this for a long, long time. It's been doubling every year in my career in Bitcoin, and that's always my forecast. If you want to know where I think it'll be in a year, it's probably 130,000, you know, and sometimes I'm a little behind, sometimes a little ahead, but really over any period of time, it has been doing that. And I think I'll keep doing that for quite a while. We might even exceed that because you mentioned there were a lot of very, very rare and crazy things that happened that were negative shocks to the blockchain ecosystem in 2022 and 2023. And all of those are at least gone and neutral. And some of them actually swing around, like the ETF being approved is a huge positive. And actually way more important, I would say, than the futures being approved by the CFTC in 2017.
When you look at the volatility of this asset, and you know, I'm talking to you on a day after Bitcoin reached its all-time high, it then dropped immediately, went from 69,000 to 59,000. Now it's at 66,000. How do you get comfortable with that? Again, I'm asking you to be empathetic about this because I'm asking it from the eyes and ears of a retail investor joining the Wealthy On Network, trying to help out their families.
Yeah, so it is highly volatile. One thing to think about, though, is in our training in Wall Street, we were always taught volatility is bad. The way I think about blockchain and Bitcoin is it's like a call option on the future payment rail of the world. And when you're long an option, you love vol, right? Like, it's great. And so in the 15 years of Bitcoin, most of the volatility has been to the upside. There's certainly been some big bear markets. And, you know, yesterday is something, you know, that tests the faint of heart. But what people should do is only put the amount of money they're willing to suffer an 80% drop and still, like, have their spouse like them. And don't put more than that into Bitcoin. You'll be fine. And you definitely, as long as you're willing to hold it for a few years, maybe even 5 or 10, that's the way to think about it. It's like a venture, although it has instantaneous 24/7 trading, think of it like a venture investment. Figure out how much money you're willing to lose, just put that amount in, and then, you know, hold it.
All right, I'm putting my Unabomber, I hate the government, total full-on libertarian. I've got, you know, ready-made meals in my basement and, you know, A15s, A16s. They take this asset away from us. I've got Bitcoin OG guys saying to me, and obviously Michael Saylor and I have had this conversation, but I got Bitcoin OG guys saying to me, oh, this is a disaster. These coins are all going to get consolidated into this 11 or 12 ETFs, and then the government's going to pull ripcord and have it taking all this property from us. And what say you, Mr. Moritz?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that although theoretically possible, it's just like it's very, very small odds, right? There's 400 million people around the world that have Bitcoin. Probably 40 million Americans have Bitcoin. It seems very kind of out there to think the government's going to confiscate something that so many voters have. And then lastly, man, it's hard to confiscate something that's decentralized and in the cloud, right?
Yeah, well, that was the point. They'll confiscate it by taking the ETFs, which are a form of centralization.
Yeah, that's a long-running debate, you know, that Satoshi envisioned this totally decentralized world, and then we get Coinbase and BlackRock, right? But I view this as kind of an interregnum state in 20 years, we're not going to be using those things anymore. Everyone's just going to have a wallet on their smartphone, and they're going to, you know, not be needing things like ETFs.
Before I take questions from the audience, Dan, can you tell us a little bit about your venture business? What do you think about in venture? What are some of the exciting companies that you're looking at or ideas, maybe themes in venture? on the digital space, perhaps AI or whatever it is that you guys work on?
Yeah, so we launched the first crypto fund in the US, and then a couple of months later launched the first blockchain venture fund with the premise that it's going to change so many different businesses that, you know, we want to invest in entrepreneurs that we can use blockchain to do things better, faster, and cheaper. And, you know, we still think there's another couple decades of incredible innovation in blockchain space. So our firm's actually about 80% venture and only 20% token investing, because a lot of the opportunities are in the venture space. And we've seen a lot of cool opportunities still in the exchange space. You know, there's still some exchanges we're investing in. We, like, for example, we're invested in Bitso in Mexico. They already do almost 10% of all US to Mexico remittance over Bitcoin. And no one writes that article because it's good news. You know, like you can't sell newspapers writing good news. You want to talk about bad things that happen. But 3 million Mexicans are helped by Bitcoin every year. It's awesome. So we're still investing in those things. There's a lot to do in the scaling space. We've been a big investor in Arbitrum and Starkware, which are very prominent scaling solutions in Bloxroute. Because Bitcoin and Ethereum only do 10 transactions per second, and those need to do more. There's a lot still to do in Web3. The concept of taking all these really cool web companies like Airbnb, Spotify, and doing it in a decentralized, cooperatively owned, cooperatively governed way. You know, so there's a huge amount to do there as well.
Liz, I like you, I love the space, and I'm fascinated by wading into these things. I think that the thing that I'm trying to do on this show, and you've been very helpful, is to get people to calm down, get people to see what you see and what I see. And so I want to put you at the kitchen table of a person. He's a 50-year-old. He's got two kids about to go to college. He's setting up his IRA and he's setting up his investment portfolio. Give him some advice, Dan. How does he stretch himself away from just the 60-40 stock and bond allocation? What do you say to a person like that? And again, I'm just generics.
Yeah. And so for that, I really do think, you know, everyone should have an allocation to blockchain. And, you know, if you have some kids going to college, you might need the money. You got to keep it in the single digit percentages of your portfolio, because it really can go down, you know, 60 or 80% in the future. But to get a at least Bitcoin and Ethereum, but potentially a broader mix of things. And even just Bitcoin and Ethereum is a pretty good kind of simple portfolio to have of how to get exposure to the space. And then again, do it in a size you can hold it for 2 or 3 or 4 years. Cause, you know, there might be some bumps, like you said yesterday, 10%, you know, downdraft in the market could easily happen a bunch again, but it'd be pretty hard to imagine 4 or 5 years from now, the price is being lower than they are today.
All right, let's take some questions. Why don't we fire in the first question? I think it's a good one for you, Dan. Where do you see the trajectory of Ethereum in the next 6 to 18 months? And this is from Lachlan in Sydney, Australia.
Yeah, so we're very bullish on Ethereum. It's obviously the second biggest blockchain, but it has, you know, a ton of developers on it. And so although we think blockchain generally is going to continue its almost 100% compound annual growth rate, Ethereum might overperform. It's currently about 35% of the value of the Bitcoin market cap. We could imagine seeing that inch up over time.
All right, let's go to the next question. As a fellow Long Islander, what tips do you have for young families starting to invest? We are hit hard with the very high taxes that max out the SALT deduction, let alone the housing costs. This is from Eddie from Merrick, Long Island. You know, Mr. Moorhead, I believe, is in Puerto Rico. Do I have that correct, sir?
I am a resident of Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico. And so in Puerto Rico, you only pay 4% tax, Eddie from Merrick. Okay, it was one of my favorite towns. I used to hang out in the Oceanside Nathans as a kid. And so if you're an older guy like me, Eddie, you'll remember that place. But for Mr. Moorhead's benefit, SALT is state and local tax deductions. Of course, they're limited now to only $10,000. So it's really hurt this area. We've seen 500,000 people, frankly, leave New York since the 2017 SALT deduction cap went into place. But I, if you like Long Island like me, Eddie, and I'm not leaving, you know, I'm going to be shutting the lights out on Long Island, and perhaps with you, I would listen to Mr. Moorhead, and I would make an allocation towards Bitcoin, because he is, you know, obviously a brilliant guy. And if you can accept some volatility, so small percentages of it, I think you'll do very well. It'll expand your portfolio and it'll give you and your family some breathing room. Anything you want to add to that, Dan?
No, I agree with what you said. And I just add that it's very fortunate that in 2013, the IRS was way ahead of some of their peers in the regulatory community. And they ruled on cryptocurrencies and said that they're not currencies, actually, they're property. And so you get long-term capital gains tax treatment. So that is a huge plus compared to some of the other things that you might be investing in out there.
All right, great answer. Let's go to the next question. What's your view on The Great Taking by David Webb? Okay, so I'll take this. I've actually read it. This is Jim from Calgary. And so the notion there, Dan, is about a great taking by the government of your assets. And so the word taking is actually an old property term. You know, the government has the ability through eminent domain, to do a taking. Now, what has been grounded in U.S. property law, U.S. contract law, is they can't do that without offering you fair market value. But a lot of people sometimes have a dispute over what fair market value is. As an example, Dan and I probably think our Bitcoin is going to 400,000. So we certainly wouldn't want to give it to the government here at 66,000. And so, but David, the thing that I would tell you is if they went to implement a quote unquote great taking, there would be a revolution. And that's been historically accurate for the last 5,000 years. So I don't see that happening. It's an interesting and fascinating apocalyptic type of book, but I am not worried about that. I think this is one of the big benefits of joining us on Wealthion. I'm trying to dispel people from these like ninth sigma notions of the apocalypse. Mr. Moorhead and myself have made our money by going down the middle and having a good long-term program and believing in the faith of our property laws, the faith of our contract and our legal system. And that certainly proved to be the case here in 2024. You know, Mr. Gensler, due to political purposes, tried to stop the Bitcoin ETF, but he wasn't able to do that because we have a very decentralized government. We have lots of checks and balances in the system. So I wouldn't overly worry about that. I don't know if Dan wants to chime in anything there, but that's what The Great Taking is.
Yeah, Andy, I would totally agree with you that we shouldn't worry about those kind of nine sigma events that, you know, probably aren't going to happen. There are very silent takings, though, that have just happened in the policy space. They printed $2 trillion of new money, new paper money, and that has debased the value of paper money and inflated the value of everything that is in fixed quantity, mm-hmm. whether it's the S&P 500 at record highs, whether it's real estate. Homes in the United States went up 40%, like everywhere, not just the hottest markets, everywhere. And so in my opinion, it is somewhat of a taking because the majority of Americans are under 40. They don't have a big house, right? Like, and so, you know, government policies really are impacting citizens. And although I believe that very deeply from a political standpoint, the actual answer is the same: buy Bitcoin, right? Like there's only 21 million of them. They're not going to make any more. So if you are worried about the government kind of debasing the value of your assets, you know, it is good to store some of your wealth in something that they can't debase.
So, I mean, it's a very insightful answer. And Jim, you got to listen carefully what Dan is saying, because that inflation does eat up people. It really bothers me, by the way, guys, because, you know, this happened to my father in the 1970s. And just, you know, he was a blue collar worker. He had hourly wages. The wages came in. He had massive inflation. And all of a sudden, the purchasing power for the family went down, even though he was working super hard at the same job. And so, without the stability in the currency, what happens is you get a lot of people become disenfranchised. And I think this is impacting our political system. There's a very large group of people in our country, perhaps also in Canada, that are saying, hey, this is really unfair what's happening. And so in a weird way, Bitcoin, as it continues to expand and exponentially grows, and Dan and I see it as a hard asset because it's 21 million coins. It can be broken up into Satoshis, of course, but it's a hard fixed asset with limited supply. It sort of takes the drunk drivers, also known as central bankers and policymakers in these big governments that are printing this money. It takes the drunk driving keys away from them, and it forces people into a stricter accounting system. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's a great way to say it. That it's kind of putting monetary power back into the people's hands, right? Like, nobody asked me to vote on whether the Fed should do 200% of all mortgage lending in the U.S. for 2020 and 2021. That was crazy, but I didn't get to vote. Whereas with Bitcoin, I vote with my wallet.
All right, well, really, really good answer there. Let's go to the next one. Where do you put our money while we wait for the dollar to fall and BRICS to rise? Okay, this is Gary from Austin, Texas. And so I think Dan and I both believe Bitcoin is an asset where you should put some of that money. But where are those other places? You're a great macro trader. You've been around a while. What other places would you, besides Bitcoin, where would you put money to create an inflation hedge for people relative to the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, so I think the answer does come back to anything of fixed quantity. And rates are still so low, you know, they're really just basically right above inflation. So you still want to be long things that have a fixed quantity. So real estate's a classic, you know, it's a good hedge against debasing the dollar. You know, cryptocurrencies are good. So anything that's got a fixed quantity is where you want to be.
Any other questions out there, team? How do you see Great Britain in the next few years? This is Jack from Exeter, UK. Go ahead, Mr. Moorhead. What do you say?
Well, I've lived and worked in the United Kingdom twice and loved it, but I don't have any particular insight on the UK now. I'm so focused on Bitcoin.
So I'll say something that I've noticed, and like Dan, I've lived and worked in the United Kingdom. And I love your country. I will point that out. I am a little bit of an Anglophile, but I will say this: I like the energy. I feel like it was a mistake to Brexit. Some of you disagree with me on that, but if you look at the economic data, the country's economy shrunk post Brexit. It didn't need to, but I like the energy in the country now related to entrepreneurship and adaptation, and it's forcing the UK government to go in that direction. And I see the digital space as it relates to financial services leadership. The UK, I think, is more forward than even the United States as it relates to the digital space. So I think there are some bright years ahead for the UK and for the GB, as you say, Jack. What's the next question? What alternative to treasuries yielding 5% and market, but the market remaining frothy? What alternatives you have out there besides treasuries yielding 5%? And why aren't institutions putting greater allocations to the government considering this backdrop? So markets are frothy. We've got a 5% yield. Where do you go with the money? Yes, Bitcoin, but what other places, Dan?
Yeah, you know, I would actually say in this environment, cash is better than long bonds. You know, they've printed an enormous amount of money. Inflation's been very, very high. And the 10-year note's 4.25 right now. That doesn't really give you much leeway, you know? Inflation's been running at decades highs. And I think the problem is it's really a labor shortage rather than any of these other excuses that, you know, people have said. And, you know, you're starting to get cost of living increases built into contracts like the 70s. I lived through the 70s as well. And those are all coming back. So many stats are very similar to the 70s and the 80s. And so I really do see inflation staying much, much higher over the next 5 or 10 years. So, you know, cash actually is a decent alternative. Oh, you know, because there was a pricing in of the Fed cutting, you know, rates down to 2 or 3% a year ago. The Fed's not cutting for a long time. You know, there's still a lot of issues.
All right. So I want, before I let you go, I want you to play Fed Chair just for one moment, okay? Because you're in a little bit of a box as the Fed chair, Chairman Moorhead. You have $34 trillion of deficit. The U.S. government's decided they're not going to do anything to solve that crisis. So we're spending 5 to 6% of our GDP in deficit spending. Seem to be getting away with it now, but perhaps not forever. So you have pressure on the budget because we're going to go over $1 trillion of interest expenses as our debt rolls in the next couple of years. I guess 38% of it's rolling in the next 2 or 3 years. So you got that issue. And then you have the issue of this inflation that you're describing. Okay, so what do you do? You're in the box. Where do you move rates over the next 18 to 24 months?
I know this is a controversial answer, but I don't think you do. I think they're going to stay here because the Fed's dual mandate is to keep inflation, is quote, stable prices, somehow debasing our currency 2% a year is now called stable. But, you know, if you said that to anybody else, that sounds terrible. But so they're only supposed to debase your purchasing power by 2% every year anymore.
Right.
And we're still, you know, way above that. And they're supposed to maintain, quote, full employment. And I think we all would agree we're beyond that, you know, that the unemployment rate's so low, we have a lot of wage inflation. So I don't see the Fed cutting at all. And frankly, you know, there's a 30% chance the next move's a hike a year and a half from now. I'm not saying like next week, but I think the Fed's just going to be sitting here not being able to cut. And that's why I think cash is a decent alternative, because you're going to get 5% for the next couple of years.
All right. Well, it's been an amazing to have you on, Dan. I really am grateful. Any last words for our audience before I let you go?
Yeah, honestly, the thing I've been spreading, you know, around is just try and get over the hump to get a little bit of exposure to the crypto. Because once you do, you start reading about it, you'll realize it is that important, you know, and ultimately you'll probably, you know, really do well with it.
Well, I want to offer you at a personal thank you, because you were wading in the water long before me. And the water seemed pretty warm for you. So I said, all right, I got to get to understand this and got to get in there. So I want to thank you for your intellectual leadership and helping us get there. One of the real pioneers in the crypto space, an OG, as I say. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Moorhead, thank you for joining us on Speak Up.
Anthony, thank you.